Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because
each night we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with something called a solution, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues it faces every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network. And it is Michael Hohmeyer. Michael, welcome back.
Thank you, Michael Ray. Great to be with you.
Oh, and thank you. I have a question for you. And as we were moving our way into starting, and it's the law section. Now, I won't ask you how many years it's been since you've been to law school, but it's been a few, right?
Way back in the mists of time, I think dinosaurs still ruled the earth.
Okay, I got that one loud and clear. Now, let me ask you this. If you were knowing what's going on in the world today, and especially here in the country with the argument based on the difference between the rule of law, the rule of man, we don't have to belabor it. We know about interpretation, etc. Do you think if you went through law school today, it would be the same law school?
I know that it would not. I know that because the way that the law is taught today and the way that it then is practiced by practitioners in the real world is radically different than the law that I learned, and actually it was back in the early 1980s, and the law that I started practicing. And in fact, when I was teaching, it was the law that I taught, only to find out that I was right on the cusp of the changing times.
Michael, did we drop you by chance? Seth, guardian angel, I think we lost our guest. Okay, good. All right, we're talking to Michael Hohmeyer, and it's the law portion of Dresser After Dark. And an interesting question, you know, Michael went to law school back in the 80s. Michael is also an adjunct professor. He teaches law at the local universities in the Los Angeles area. And the question to him was the law that he learned the same law that he would learn today? And there seems to be a difference between the two. And how can you have a difference in the definition of what the law is? We had, early on, we had something called the rule of law, and it was basically A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and if you did something, it fell into a category. Based on that category, there were consequences for the actions that you would take. Now, today there's more of something called the rule of man. It's interpretation of the law, and it's going to be different from state to state to state to state. So in essence, what we're saying here is you could be arrested for a particular crime, whatever the case may be, or accused of something, and it could be in California, and you could have a judge and jury in three or four different states, and the outcome is going to be completely different based on time and place and geographic location and how they look at it. And there's something very scary about that. It's scary about it because there's no, let's use the C word, consistency. There is not any consistency. You cannot guarantee what an outcome is going to be. And for the most part, we're high tech when we get into something today, which is no question about it. And we do totally want to be fair. There's no question about that. Because somebody is accused of something doesn't necessarily mean that right now they're at the mercy of whatever's going on. It's not so. But when we deal with it, if you interpret the law, then you interpret the Constitution. And if you interpret the Constitution, it is not the same guidelines that you and I were brought up with, the same guidelines that keeps us and protects us. You like the word, protects us. So in essence, what we do is we get lost in the shuffle here. When you get lost in the shuffle, you get confused, and when you get confused, there are no rules and regulations to follow, and that is scary. If you want a free and open society like I've heard some people ask for, a free and open society is this. There aren't any laws. There's nobody there to protect you. If somebody's bigger than you are, they're going to come into your house and take everything that they can if you are not big enough to protect yourself against them. That is a free and an open society. Do what you want when you want and not a problem in any way, shape, or form. Now, the key here is this, that when we look at whatever the law is, we have to deal with something called, and listen very closely, something called humanity. And what is that humanity? Because what we are dealing with, for the most part, is the ability to keep you safe. That's what the law was created for. And when you have police officers out there that quote-unquote can't shoot. Now, by the way, there's some bad guys on the police force. There's no question. There have been some infractions of law that there have been a problem with. But for the most part, when they're worried about protecting you, when you're a Border Patrol agent and you get sued for carrying out what you're supposed to do, you get sued by a drug dealer who got stopped delivering drugs across the border and got shot in the rear end, and you're the Border Patrol person that did it. Now, all of a sudden, you're in jail for carrying out your job. It's scary to be a police officer anymore. It is scary to go to the court system today. And if we're not sure of what we have, that's where the major confusion is. And it trickles down. Michael, are you there yet? Okay. It's a trickle-down effect. And when we talk about trickle-down, it comes from the top and it moves its way down. The model that is set in the administration, whatever administration it is, it could be Republican, Democrat, Independent, it doesn't. Okay, but the model that is set is what we follow. Okay, Michael, I'm going to go back to, sorry, I don't know what happened. That White House, they know we're at it again, don't they?
It's those gremlins again.
They got you. Okay, basically what I was talking about before you came back was the difference between the rule of law, the rule of man, interpretation, and there's no consistency. And because there's no consistency, you can't guarantee yourself comfort knowing that you, if you go in, if there is a law that's broken, an A, B, C, D, E, F, G rule should be followed. And if that's not going to happen because somebody's interpretation of what the law should be, we are in a very scary situation.
You know, that is so incredibly important of an observation. It shows that what goes on in our society politically and in the law has economic repercussions. Look, a large part of the business law practice that my firm is engaged in is contract law. And the contract law has come down over the centuries in order to give people the benefit of the bargain that they make. If they make a contract with someone where they're going to do or get something and they're going to pay or whatever, depending on which side of the transaction they're on, they have a means to enforce that deal. They can get what it is that they bargained for, or if necessary, something to compensate them to put them in the same position. The law exists to enforce contracts and therefore to help increase business. A huge part of the law's value in that area is its predictability. It says to people, look, don't go to court if you don't perform your contract. This will happen to you because it's happened to other people, and we stand up for upholding contracts, so don't break it in the first place. In other words, it helps facilitate economic activity. When you take away the predictability, when you make contract partners uncertain as to whether or not the law will back them up, either at all or perhaps because they are of a group that the law appears to be disfavoring, then they have no predictability, they have no certainty that the deal they get into is actually going to be enforced, and so they're disinclined to do those deals. That chills economic activity and only prolongs the kind of economic slowdown or recession that we're in right now. So you're absolutely right. If we have a government of laws and not of men, where we have no favorites being played, but the law applied blindly. Remember, justice has got a blindfold on?
Sure. Something happened. I think, Michael, we lose you again. Okay, justice, I'll continue on with that. We'll get him back. Justice should have a blindfold on. And the reason that they should have a blindfold on is because they should not be injecting their own feelings, their own thoughts, their own something on the Supreme Court. If you have somebody who's gay on the Supreme Court, there should be a blindfold. They should not have a particular perspective of a subject matter because they're of a particular persuasion, a they're a gender, they're an ethnicity, they're a sexual orientation, or whatever it is, it's called, it's blind. I have never personally, up to lately, I've never personally cared for Hillary Clinton. My politics and her politics would clash if we were face-to-face and we met. But if Hillary Clinton would have become the president of the United States, Hillary would have then become my president. Then if justice is blind, so should the constituency be blind. Blind meaning don't put your own feelings into it. And we've got Supreme Court judges who do. We have people that are on juries who do. We have people, judges, we have people in places of authority who do. They've got the blindfold off. That's where it's scary. This last November, when there was a re-election again in the House, the Democrats lost the House, the Republicans picked up the House. Everybody got fed up. You had some youngsters in there. You had people that had no experience politically that were going to come in and they were going to do a job. I have my fingers crossed they will do that job. Whether they're Republican or Democrat, it really doesn't matter at this stage of the game. And I really believe we better start defining what a Democrat and a Republican is. A Republican. I'm right to center. That's the way I've been for many, many years now. I'm right to center. Now, do I believe that a woman has the right to choose? Absolutely. It's not up to me to tell her what to do with her body. Now, when taxpayers have to pay for it, that's another story, a step in a different direction. So where am I? Would that not make me a Republican again? If I want to protect the country and I'm all for going to war, if that's what it's going to do to protect the people of this country, am I now a baby killer? You see the words, the labels that get stuck when we are dealing with these things. So you don't have a Democrat. Good. Hi, Michael. I'm glad you're back. Let me do this real quick. You don't just have a Democrat. You have a Democrat. You have a liberal, and then you have a progressive. There are three levels. Now, when I'm talking about a particular person, what level am I talking about? Take it over to the Republican side, too. You've got your moderate, and then you've got somebody who's extreme, etc. So really, who speaks? It's the extreme end of the ideology, and you can take that right to court, too. Michael, I don't know what's going on tonight, but I am so glad you're back.
Happy to be back with you. These are really important points, and there is an absolute intersection with what you're talking about, politics, government, and the legal business, because the legal business is to help facilitate business. And when the legal system is impacted, that affects business.
No, absolutely. There was something else that I touched on when you were gone for a while. And that what I touched on was this. I want to go back to mid-60s when the Vietnam War was over with. General, was it Yap? I can't remember what his name was. But he was the general that was against us. At the Tet Offensive, they knew they lost the war. It was ours. But the peace marchers started up in our country. And based on the strength of the peace marchers, et cetera, they got new hope and they came back to fight us. It cost us a tremendous amount of lives out there, you know, in the war in Vietnam. So in essence, we stepped on our own feet, which brings me to this. What the peace marchers are wanting is basically something called a free and open society. A free and open society is a very scary thing. Michael, what that means is that if I'm bigger than you, I go into your house, I take what I want, and I leave. If you're not big enough to stop me, too bad. You see, that's a society that we have without the rule of law, without the Constitution, without the guidelines that allow us to be who we are and what we've had.
There's a reason why every depiction from classical times on of the goddess of justice has been of a woman holding the scales, wearing a blindfold. The ideal depiction of justice is that it is blind. It does not favor the wealthy over the poor or the strong over the weak, or vice versa, for that matter. It is to be impartial. Once upon a time when I was a young lawyer, that impartiality was everything within the legal business. Today, within the legal business, it seems to be that the blindfold has come off and that different justice exists for different people, especially those who are favored by the ruling class today.
Now, by the way, interesting point. Ruling class. What's happened in the last 2 years, it has been a class warfare like I've never seen it before. There has been a division in the races like I have never seen it before. There's some very interesting things going on here for the pure protection of one ideology, and it's not a race, it's an ideology. Because if you listen to what Martin Luther King said, it had nothing to do with what's going on today and with Louis Farrakhan would say. But the point of contention is they get lost between the two. And once you get lost between the two, it can be used as a very powerful political weapon.
And what seems to be so odd, based on what you're saying, and we observe it to be true in our daily practice. We have clients from every racial group. We have clients from various economic groups. Not just larger clients and what I guess you'd say wealthier individuals, but mom and pops in some cases, folks starting businesses from, they can be recent immigrants, they can be people who've been here for a very long time. It doesn't really seem to matter. People have the entrepreneurial spirit across the class lines, across racial, gender, whatever lines the society seems so eager today to kind of highlight. In real world, our clients, it's very much a rainbow, not because we went out to make a point, but that's just because of the folks who've come to us to work with us, help them grow their businesses and start their businesses. And when you have an experience like that every day, when you're working with these kinds of people from various diverse backgrounds, doing various diverse things, you wonder, well, if this is the real world, then what is it that I hear about on TV? And what is it that I hear about from the news? They seem to be describing, at least the elites do, an America which isn't the same America as the one that I'm living my daily life with as a business attorney.
Now, by the way, I have, and hear this out, I have a tremendous amount of prejudice. I do. I always have. But it's not color, Michael. It's consciousness. There's white people I won't let into my house. And I think that's really where the problem is. It's when they talk about crossing the color line, et cetera, so on and so forth. That really, there's prejudice still. There's no question. But I think there's a fire lit under it. And I think it's been, I think it's been fed for the last couple of years. But for the most part, it is not what it used to be. There are not separate bathrooms and separate water fountains, and you can't go to this school, and if you're a certain color, you can't walk into a restaurant. That doesn't exist anymore. And I give you the maximum, the ultimate, I'm at, well, same thing. I give you the ultimate example of that is Barack Obama. We have an African-American president. Tell me that we keep people that held off and not being able to move forward. You don't get into a higher position than that.
That's absolutely right, and his election is a testament to the real progress that has been made, and I think that most people believe that very real progress has been made. I wouldn't go so far as to say complete progress. I agree with you. There's much work still to be done, but
sure.
Compared to when I started practicing in the early 1980s, where the client makeup was pretty much one gender, women businesses, women-owned businesses, women entrepreneurs were the exception, not the rule. The same thing for minority groups. The same thing with, at least on the level of work that I was doing with immigrants, as well as versus those who'd been here for a long time. Our practice has changed dramatically in the last 28 years. And today, you would look at the folks that we work with and say, man, there's been tremendous progress. And while there may be work to be done, isn't it also accurate and fair that we sit back and say this is really the state of the progress that has been made and give it the credit that it's due? I think it's high time.
Michael, let me give you one other thing where we've lost. And I'm going to say we're losing. We've almost lost it. And we've only got a couple of minutes to do this. But if you go all the way back to the great American frontier, it was the parents who taught their kids the skills that were needed to survive in a hostile environment. They taught them how to shoot. They taught them how to ride. They taught them how to farm. They taught them how to fish. And at that time, the kids would typically look up to their mom and dad. They had a one-room school for a year or two. They learned how to read. They learned how to write, maybe do a little bit of math. But the skills they really needed to survive were taught to them by their parents. And for that reason alone, children looked up to their parents. There were bonds going on. You know, they respected the man who taught them how to ride and how to shoot, and the woman who taught them how to bake and to sew, and life was very simple. Fast forward that to a highly specialized commercial society, and it was a society in which children no longer learned their survival skills from their parents, different survival skills now. Children did not now follow into the vocational footsteps of their parents. this all happened so suddenly. What occurred was the state assumed the educational function that was once left to the parents. Even learning how to drive a car, the modern equivalent to learning how to ride a horse, is something that kids learn how to do in driver's ed class. So effectively, what I'm saying here, it's been the role models have been taken away from the parents, and they've been given to the government. And that's where I think the problem is. And one of the problems we have, not only going back to the Constitution, is finding out where the parents are supposed to go to learn how to be parents today. You hear it.
Absolutely. Government has, and the ruling elites have, arrogated to themselves power that does not belong to them. They've taken that power and they've only made a mess of things. In most ways, I would say that we are worse off than we were when we had less material prosperity, but we had more independence, more freedom, and more responsibility, more of an obligation that we imposed upon ourselves to rise to those responsibilities and to carry them out for ourselves. I think that's also an undercurrent of what's going on politically as well. We'll see how far it gets played out next year, I bet.
And by the way, attorneys now have got a brand new circle, and we're going to have to close it with this, but a brand new circle of clients, and it's the 12 and 13-year-olds, well, maybe the 9 or 10-year-olds, when they sue their parents. So, I mean, there's a lot of money to be made there. There's got to be.
Well, no, certainly for some attorneys, but not all. Those of us who toil on behalf of businesses aren't involved with the trial lawyers on those kinds of litigation matters. And there can be, even within our profession, a big divide between the trial lawyers and non-trial lawyers.
Oh, absolutely. No, but you got it loud and clear. Hugh, go to bed. I'm calling my attorney, pal. Okay, and that's really what's going on. Michael Hohmeyer, hey, thanks for being here. Website we can find you at?
www.hohmeyerlaw.com, spelled HOMEIERLAW.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Michael, we'll see you next week.
Sounds great, Michael Ray. Thank you.
Good night.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see?
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there, so tell me why.
It's time for tips from the publishing guru. Todd Rutherford back with us, founder of the AskThePublishingGuru.com. And as a consultant, he's been involved with writing, publishing, marketing for more than 2,500 different books and counting. Hey, Todd, welcome back.
It's great to be here, Michael. How is your day?
Oh, my day has been really good. As a matter of fact, it's been. Have you ever had all of a sudden a quiet part of the day? I know that's hard to fathom anymore, but it does happen occasionally.
Actually, I can't remember the last time that I had that experience.
Saying that. All right, let's go back to where we were last week, because I think it's very important that we move to move through, and we didn't get a chance to do so. Blogs. WriterUnboxed.com. What do I get if I go there?
Well, it's one of the blogs that I follow regularly, and if you follow my feed on Twitter, Publishing Guru is my ID on Twitter, you'll get links on a daily basis, 20 to 25 on most days. Myself and my staff send out basic links to different articles on various different blogs having to do with writing, publishing, marketing, books. Writer Unboxed is one of my favorites because there's several different contributors in the industry from various different fields, and so always providing really good content. And recently, there was a post on there about some of the different things that agents, literary agents, look at when they see something like this on a query letter or book proposal that they receive from an author. These are like there's like a top 10 list of things that raise a red flag for them that basically cause them to file it in the trash can. And so, you know, I thought it would be great to chat a little bit to kind of give some first-time authors taking a look at pursuing the traditional publishing path, you know, give them a heads up on some of the different things they need to be really careful for, because they're very common mistakes, but they can really be the difference between your book having a chance of being considered or being put in the trash can.
By the way, do you find, Todd, that most new ones coming in, newbies coming in that really haven't had a lot of experience, they overkill with the amount of information they give to a potential talk show, to a TV show, to maybe somebody's going to take a look at their book and review it to give them the thumbs up, thumbs down? Is there an overkill?
Absolutely. It's basically the common phrase, you know, show, don't tell. In our natural state, we have a tendency to feel like we need to provide information. And so what comes across to the is sentence. And you're just telling something. You know, fiction writers especially can make a big mistake in this area where they're basically allowing the reader to experience the story. If you're doing it properly, you're allowing the reader to experience the story through the character's actions, words, thoughts, senses, and feelings, rather than through your role as the narrator, you know, just basically describing what's happening. John went over and stubbed his toe and got angry. That would be the that would be telling too much instead of actually representing that information by, through John's actions, words, thoughts, and senses. You can communicate that he stubbed his toe and got angry without actually telling it, but showing the reader what's happening. And so that's one of the things you want to definitely take a look at in your material and in your writing. Are you telling your reader what's happening, or are you showing and creating an environment where they experience what's happening with the characters?
And I think what happens a lot, too, I just reached around, I picked up a book, I want to do something, and I just arbitrarily opened the page up. It's like this. 1905, Einstein shocked the scientific world by asserting that mass was another form of energy. Mass seems nothing like any previously known form of energy, such as heat or kinetic energy, other forms of intangibles you can't touch, kinetic energy. Mass is very different. It's in the epitome of being tangible. Heat can only be... Okay, what did I just say?
Yeah, exactly. You lost me completely. So there's a great example of even a work of nonfiction where the author obviously... if it's a textbook, and then, you know, even then I don't like it, but still you could probably get away with that in a textbook. But if your intention is to persuade and move and educate or entertain your reader, then you definitely need to move beyond and say, how can I communicate what I desire to communicate to the reader about this particular topic, subtopic, theme, or scene of the novel? How can I communicate it in a way that is showing the reader and create experience for the reader rather than narrating to them what's happening?
By the way, did I ever tell you the story about the man on the street?
The man, which one?
this was the one about somebody sent me a video, and stop me if I've told you this before, but someone sent a video to me. Oh, must have been about 4 or 5 years ago. And as long as I've been in communication, this video said everything that I've ever thought, that I've ever felt, that I've ever talked about as far as connecting with another person, an audience, whatever the case may be. It started out in any given city in the country, doesn't really matter where, and it zeroed in on the main street. Now, it's about noon, so it's very busy. You got very heavy-duty traffic. It allowed you to feel the traffic for a moment, the honking of horns and humming of the engines, squealing brakes, and then it moved you over to the sidewalk. Now, you have the same busyness with the pedestrians, the foot traffic, probably 4 or 5 shoulder-to-shoulder going both ways. Very busy. As a matter of fact, they were in a hurry to go nowhere. You could see it. Very blank looks on their faces. It just, they didn't exist. On the corner, or on the street, or I'm sorry, on the sidewalk, there's a man sitting. He's got his back up against the building. He's about 70. He's blind. He's disabled, and he's probably a war vet. He's got a hat next to him for donations, and then he has a sign, and the sign says, "Please help me. I'm hungry." Now, people are walking by this guy, and they're not paying attention to him. And had you been sitting with me watching this, you wouldn't have been surprised if somebody would have stepped on him. Todd, the guy did not exist. Young man with a hat, young man with a suit on walked by, and he dropped some coins in and noticed that nobody's paying attention to him. So he walked over and he wrote something on the sign. He changed something. And people started putting money in the hat, and the hat started to fill up. And the young man smiled and he walked away. And then the camera panned back over to the sign. The sign that had said, "Please help me, I'm hungry," was now changed to say, "What if you were hungry?" That's communication. That's bringing
that's powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. So
that's
now
a
it's
perfect
me.
Example of the difference between telling someone and showing someone and creating an experience that moves them to action or involvement in the story, whatever the case may be. That's powerful.
Yeah. And that's exactly what you were talking about, the telling instead of showing. Because if you involve me and if I see myself within the context of the story, and because if you really bring it down to it, what you're dealing with is now they weren't giving money to him, they were giving money to themselves. And everybody saw
exactly.
themselves in that sign.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll immediately begin to think that you're just one paycheck away from being in his exact shoes.
That's not him, that's me right there. And that's really, really what it is. Now, the other side of that, loose sentence structures could easily be tightened up. You know, it's got to be to a point where there's that old adage, don't sell the way that you buy. Because what really happens here is they don't think the way you'd think. They don't think the way I think. They think the way they think. And if you break your sentence structures down, they're not going to catch what you mean by what you say. And you could lose a tremendous amount of the audience, whether it's written or you know, verbal or if it's visual.
Sure. The simplest way to describe the problems that most people have with loose sentence structure is it just means really the sentence is way longer than it needs to be. You know, an example would be a simple, solid, nice, clean sentence would be, "I ate the pizza." But then you could begin to expand that to say something like, "I ate the pizza that my sister baked." That's still acceptable, but it's starting to become longer. But then when you start saying something like, "I ate the pizza that my sister baked after I got home from work," well, then the question starts to get muddy for the reader. Did your sister bake the pizza after you got home from work, or did you only eat the pizza after you got home from work? You see, the longer the sentence gets, the more difficult it is for the reader to actually put relationship of the modifiers in to the main part. It just becomes more difficult for the reader the longer the sentence gets.
And there's another thing to add to that. Okay, you got me going now. There's another thing to add to that. If you say, "Yeah, I ate the pizza," now everybody's going to resonate to eating the pizza. They're going to see themselves eating the pizza with you as you're writing it. But if it's "my brother," what if I don't have a brother? What if I don't have this? What if I don't have that? And you go right over the head of that person who's trying to read it because it's not about them again. But everybody ate the pizza at one time or another.
Brilliant. Brilliant addition. You know, when you write a short, simple sentence, you just want to make sure don't overextend it in an unnecessary way. Use short sentences without very many modifiers attached to make very points that are very brief and make them forceful. For instance, "I have a dream." But if you added too much to that, the more you add to that sentence, the more you lose of its power, its impact, you know. You can also include like a simple modifier at the very beginning so that a string of modifiers will not confuse the sentence's meaning. You know, like for instance, "After I got home from work, I ate the pizza that my sister baked." But yeah. I agree with you as well that the more like introducing your sister or something like that, you begin to alienate the reader as well. So keep all those things in mind as you're forming your sentences and as you're going back through the work that you've written and kind of fine-tuning it, you want to see how can I tighten up any loose sentence structure that's present.
And by the way, you know what I've found and even in doing a verbal presentation, and by the way, you have forgotten more about writing than I will ever learn. I come at it from a completely different area. But for the most part, they have to feel and see your writing there is imagery that has to happen. And if you lose the imagery, you lose the entire your entire ability to connect with that person that you're dealing with, even if you're sitting across the table from your wife, your son, your daughter, whomever, grandkids. It really doesn't matter. There is a science and there's a biology behind language.
Yes, sir.
And every bit of it.
I agree with you.
Yeah. Was something else that you did, that one of the points that I think is very powerful, starting the story in the wrong place.
It's a very common mistake that people make regarding, you know, at the when the first few pages, you basically have, I'm personally, if you don't catch me when I'm reviewing a potential work that I'm considering working with an author and helping them to, you know, pursue their publishing career, when I take a look at it, if it doesn't capture me within the first couple of pages, then basically it's gone. Now, obviously, I put myself in the shoes of the potential reader because I review a lot of material that I might not necessarily be some, it wouldn't necessarily be something that I would read, but, you know, from my experience, I'm able to put myself kind of in the potential demographic of what the book's focused for, and I try to then read it and say, okay, if I was, you know, if the book's targeting young teenage women, kind of sounds funny, but I have to imagine, okay, if I was a young teenage woman, would I enjoy this book? but you definitely have to capture people's attention in the very beginning of the story.
Sure.
And so therefore, you need to, if you start in the wrong place and you haven't captured people's attention to then pull them into the rest of the book, then basically you're going to lose. And so that's really one of the most common mistakes that people make.
Oh, absolutely. No question about that. And I really believe in my heart of hearts that a lot of it has to do with, even if you're writing a book or talking to the population at large, the giveaways have to be in front. You have to tell everybody what it's going to be and what they expect, not how they're going to get there, but what it's about. And now you've got my attention, and I'm going to spend the rest of the time reading to find out how you accomplished what you said I was going to get.
That's powerful. Yep, I agree with you completely.
Okay, and then, by the way, I was going to say, the next time I call your office, I'm going to ask if there's that teenage girl running around saying her name is Todd.
Well, one thing I don't usually have to do is pretend to be a washed-out, a fairly ignorant, elderly woman that somehow squeezed her way into a political position called Speaker of the House.
You got me. You got
me. Nancy Pelosi.
You nailed me on that one. You got me before I got you. 1 point for you. Okay. All right. We're just not running out of time. Let me ask you this. Website we can find you at?
AskThePublishingGuru.com is the best way to find me. That's my blog. More than 300 articles on writing, publishing, and marketing books. And you can also connect with me in all the different ways via email, Twitter, Facebook, etc.
Yeah, now, by the way, also, too, is there a number or something where people can, it's going to go by too fast now, but on the blog, the website, the whatever, is there a place where people can actually call you where they can get a consultation
Yes.
if they're going to do this?
Yes, there is. Actually, right on the blog at AskThePublishingGuru.com, there's a little button up on the right that says, call me.
Wonderful. Hey, Todd Rutherford, thank you so much for joining us. I am anticipating next week.
All right, we'll talk to you then.
And take care. Good night.
Good night.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is. So why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
And is our guest up?
are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see. Shark, baby, has such teeth, dear, and he shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old McAheath, baby, and he keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, baby, scarlet below.
Gotcha.
But fancy gloves, though, wears old McAheath, baby. So there's never, never a trace of red. I let them things swing on a sidewalk.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Just oozing life and someone sneaking.
Dr. Gilda Carl with his PhD. You can find her at www.drgilda.com. An internationally known psychotherapist, relationship educator. Notice it's a relationship educator and management consultant. She's on Match.com, Ask Dr. Gilda's Advice columnist. She's also known as the country music doctor who heals people's woes with her country cures. And let us say, Gilda, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you, Michael?
Oh, I'm so glad you're back. I the new book, Don't Bet on the Prince, How to Have the Man You Want by Betting on Yourself.
Now, indeed. It's always about betting on yourself and not looking at a prince to make life wonderful for you. Your life is already wonderful if you just look in the mirror and see why.
Now, by the way, most people, Gilda, are frightened to death to see that because they've been told that they're not attractive, they don't have a good personality, and they bought into it. And really,
wow.
If people just step out of themselves and say, that's their idea, that's not my idea.
Well, I wonder who has told them. I think the worst voices in our mind are those that we create ourselves. And one of my Gildagrams, and I have millions of these things, is praise and blame are both the same, which means that somebody can praise you, oh, you love that, but if they blame you, you're going to go to pieces? I don't think so. So take the praise, take the blame, just as equal opportunities for you to say thank you and then move on.
See, there's a strength that most people don't even know that it exists. And when you want to define a strong man or a strong woman, let me give you my definition of a strong woman. You say you're a dum-dum, and they say to you, and I'm good at it. It doesn't affect them. That's emotional
That's
strength.
That's exactly right. It doesn't affect you if you are strong enough to be able to walk through anything. And I define that as having a capital I. So if I say, I am Dr. Gilda Carl with a capital I, you know that. But if I say, oh, I am Dr. Gilda Carl, kind of like with a question mark, well, who am I going to attract in that case? We attract not who we want, but who we are. So I'm going to attract lowercase I people, and those are undoubtedly lowercase losers. So, and then what am I going to do? Complain about that?
No, but you can attract somebody who is going to treat you like a piece of property.
Well, that's not a good thing.
No, absolutely it's not. But that's the key. When that strength doesn't show up, when you're concerned about what people are going to think, when you don't have that confidence in yourself, that person that you will attract is somebody who's going to take over, and their false manhood, their false strength, will be acted out on your weakness.
That's exactly right, and it happens all too often. You know, as the love doc for Match.com, I get all these questions from people, and they talk about their heartache and their horrible situations with meeting people from the opposite sex, and it all starts with them. And then when I say to them, look at the mirror, look inside yourself, where did this show up? Why is this continuing to show up? Who's the constant that keeps showing up in all these relationships? And they have to say, okay, it's me. So if you change, if you grow, if you devote yourself to getting better and better and better, then you then are attracting people who are better and better and better.
I think
it's really
the difference.
A simple equation.
Sure. And I think it's the difference between needing and wanting. And there's a major difference between the two. Most people think they need to have somebody to go out with, need to have somebody accompany them to the show, need to have somebody accompany them to a restaurant. It's the difference between just wanting to go out when you want to, and if you're alone, so what? You enjoy your company, as opposed to needing to be with someone. There's where a lot of problems start also.
Oh, I so agree with you. That's one of the self-assessments in my book, Don't Bet on the Prince. Do you need XYZ or do you want XYZ? And after people finish that particular self-assessment, they say, I didn't realize that I want so much and yet I need so little. And the things that make us happy are things that we thought were wants and really are our needs fulfilled.
Okay, so when you're saying don't bet on the prince, what we're really saying here, we look underneath those words, that's just you be all you can be and don't depend on them to cause you to be who you are. Because you're going to be who you are no matter what you do, no matter who you're with. And
well,
something else.
But I wish that were so true. You are going to be who you are, but you may not enact who you really are. And so you walk away very often feeling as though you're inauthentic. And that's the worst feeling that anybody can have, whether you're a man or a woman. And plenty of men are reading this book as well. You have to be who you are and feel that you're confident about who you are. And I never say to anybody, don't love the prince, don't date the prince. I say don't depend on the prince, don't bet on the prince for your sustenance, for your financial support, for the things that you can do for yourself.
Let me give you a prime example of what I learned a long time ago. I've lived my life like this. Gilda, go ahead and ask me if I'm good looking. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll play this game. Michael, yeah. You good looking?
Well, it's funny you should ask that question. Of course I am. Of course I am. And if you don't think so, somebody else will. See, that's where I think the real key is. If I had five women standing in front of me right now, and I could get behind each one of them, Gilda, and I could look through their eyes and see me, to some of them I would be extremely attractive. To some of them I would be absolutely horrible. I can't please everybody. And I think
that's
one of the
exactly
problems
right.
are we're trying to make those people who don't think we are the best think we are the best. And it's not going to work because there's nothing you can do to cause that.
No, absolutely. Well, see, you know that lesson. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing what you do for a living.
Sure.
So, you know, your ego would be struck down immediately because in the business of media, we are always criticized because the moment you get out there, you're criticized. I remember being on Inside Edition one time and Michael Jackson was saying about some new album that he had just come out, please don't judge me. And I said, how ridiculous that is. The moment you go and dump the garbage in the garbage bin, there is somebody who's looking at you and judging you. And if I give a workshop to to 200 people, I will have 200 different reputations. And I accept that. And I say, okay, that's the way it is. Oh, well.
Gilda, I learned my lesson probably 25, 30 years ago. I was doing a workshop, and I jumped up on a chair, and I looked at the audience, and I said, describe me. And I got everything from you, loving, nurturing, wonderful individual, to your self-centered, the egotistical son of a yada, 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 right? They said, who are you talking about? They said, you. And I said, whoa, whoa, whoa. See, it was, and you know this, but it wasn't me. They were projecting and had nothing to do with me. And the people who don't like you.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. That is absolutely brilliant. When you are strong enough to realize somebody is projecting onto you that which they have as their own inadequacies, when you understand that, you say, oh, well, thank you for noticing, and you walk on.
Sure.
Because however, there are too many people who don't know that, and they say, oh, my God, I really am, blah, 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 and they take that to heart. And, you know, my mission in life is to get people to understand that they are who they believe they are. And they, in turn, because of their beliefs about themselves, teach people how to treat them.
Well, absolutely. I think, Gilda, I think it works like this in a nutshell. You and I meet, but I'm going to show you who I think you want me to be, because if I show you me, you may not like me. So we get into this great relationship, and then all of a sudden, one day you're walking out. I'm saying, why are you walking out? And you're saying, well, you're not who you were when we first met. You're changed. But I've never changed. Who I really am is coming out. And that's where I think the problem is.
I think it's a big problem. And giving advice to so many singles on Match.com, I see this every single day. They're heartbroken when they didn't open their eyes to begin with, and they didn't even want to see the reality for what they were. The red flags are always there.
Oh, sure. I know. There's something else too, and it happened. There was an interview I did, some odd years ago, and the name of the book was something like The First Kiss, which will make it or break it. And the big problem there was people don't think to ask, how do you like to be kissed? You know, we're supposed to know. As guys, we know, right? Well, no, wrong. We don't know. And how interesting it would be to ask. And do you know how many they wouldn't kill that first time out? You got the wrong kind of kiss. You don't like being kissed that way. This guy's out of here, right? But what if the guy were to ask? Now, let's take it a step further. What if you and I met and I said to you, right from the get-go, how do you receive love? And you told me, and I told you how I did. Now there's no guesswork. Now I can really, truly, if I'm going to show you love, I know exactly what it is that's going to cause you to know that that's how I feel. And we don't do that. I could give you everything. Go ahead.
I think those are wonderful questions. There is one fallacy about them, however. I think that a lot of people don't have the foggiest notion as to how they like to be kissed, how they receive love, or any of those things that are so necessary to know about yourself. And what happens is that we go into relationships, I'm using the universal we, we go into relationships thinking that the other person is supposed to do this for us, know about us. How many times I have heard from women and men, well, he should know. I mean, she should know. After all, she loves me. She's married to me. He's married to me. And he doesn't know. She doesn't know. Our partners don't know unless we tell them. But we can't tell them unless we know first and foremost.
Let me put that in another frame. You and I meet, okay? And maybe the way that I've learned to show love is the way I've learned to receive it. A wink, a look, a tone of voice, expression, something along those lines. And you, hypothetically, if I show you, I have to buy you something to show I love you. So we're going along, and I'm winking at you, and I've got the tone of voice, and I'm doing everything I can to show you I love you. 2 years later, I walk into the house, and you got your bags packed. And I said, where are you going? Well, I'm leaving. Why are you leaving? You don't love me. What do you mean I don't love me? I don't love you. You never show me. And I think that's really what it is. And going all the way back to that fallacy, if you say to somebody, how do you receive love? And if they don't know, wouldn't it be great to say, well, geez, let's find out.
Let's find out. I think that's wonderful. But I don't even know if people will say, I don't know. They may blurt something out or make something up because they're really stumped.
But you
now
take
you're
a
defining,
lot of
You're defining the different languages of love, and that is so very true. Some people react to one thing. Some people react to touch. Some people react to words of affirmation. Some people react to little gifts. But unless we know what we need, we cannot communicate that to somebody else.
I totally understand that. I mean, there's no question about it. But would it be interesting if everybody listening to the show tonight, after the show was over, sat down and said, well, you know, how do I receive love? And really got into it to find out. And wouldn't it be
I'd love to know that. I'd love to hear the results of this. I would love that. I think it's a very important question.
No, because if you don't ask the question, you're not going to know. And one of the greatest answers you can get is, I don't know. Now you're starting from a base of nothing, and you can create it any way that you want it. You don't have to just build on something that was there that may not be working.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's wonderful to be able to tell a partner you don't know, because that's showing your own vulnerability. And there's nothing more refreshing and more authentic than somebody's vulnerability. Why do we have to continue being knights in armor or superficial flowers, trying to impress, when in reality, we only really, deep down, want to be ourselves?
Sure. I mean, but that's, well, you've got a good point here, and I'm sure that most of your work is about this. What if I, hypothetically, what if I'm afraid to be me? What if I've got to bury myself, because if I'm out there, you may not like me?
You know, I call myself a relationship educator, but the most important relationship that we have is with ourselves. First and foremost, we have to know ourselves and love ourselves. Otherwise, we are wasting our time and our partner's time trying to flounder around in some kind of a relationship, which is really a battleship, because we're fighting for who we are rather than fighting for the relationship to survive.
And it's interesting, and the rhetorical question is, why do you have to fight? And I think that's what it really boils down to, because we're taught to fight. There's that inert something within all of us that will defend ourselves. The moment we think something's going wrong, they looked at us that way, they said this, you got the defense up. And if you understood your own biology, your own chemistry, and understood that maybe it wasn't them saying that, it's you interpreting that, and you got a problem and you're starting a fight for nothing.
Well, I think that our culture has set it up so that there are only winners and losers. There's no gray, and in love, I mean, you're supposed to be on the same team.
Oh, sure. No questions about it. As a matter of fact, I've decided there's a way to make a tremendous amount of money. I'm going to create something called politically correct boxing.
How is that going to work?
No hitting.
Oh, how interesting is that?
Okay, we're about ready to, we're running out of time, but there's something I just looked up here, and I've had this thing for so long, and it's brown already. That's how old this thing is. And remember the old Ann Landers column, the original Ann Landers?
Sure.
There was a column that she wrote that I kept, and I've had it for all these years, and this thing is a lot of years old. And it started out like this: Dear Ann Landers, a friend sent this to me, and she wouldn't tell me where it came from. It's one of the most beautiful things I've ever read. Will you share it with your readers, please? And that came from Hamilton, Ontario. And Ann Landers responded, Dear Hamilton, it came from my column, and I'm happy to run it again. It's also one of my favorites. It's the author of Comes the Dawn is Veronica Schofield of New York City. And here's what Veronica wrote. After a while, you learn the subtle differences between holding a hand and chaining a soul. And you learn that love doesn't mean leaning and company doesn't mean security. And you begin to understand that kisses aren't contracts and presents aren't promises. And you begin to accept your defeats with your head high and your eyes open. And with the grace of a woman, not the grief of a child, you learn to build the roads. You learn to build your roads on today's roads, because tomorrow's ground is too uncertain for plans, and futures have a way of falling down in mid-flight. And after a while, you learn that even the sunshine burns if you get too much. So you plant your own garden and you decorate your own soul instead of waiting for someone to bring you flowers. And you learn that you really can endure, and that that you are really strong and you really have the worth, and you learn and you learn and you learn, and with every goodbye, you learn.
Well, it sounds as though that could be a preface to my book, Don't Bet on the Prince.
Absolutely.
I agree with that 100%. It's beautiful.
That thing is so old. I mean, I'm serious.
Wow.
I've got to put on some. The paper is brown. And that's really what it's all about. And it's it's the prince again.
The prince believing that somebody else can unlock our beauty, whereas we have it. We know it, and we have to believe that it is worthwhile sharing.
Absolutely. We're running out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Oh, definitely. DrGilda.com, DrGilda.com. You can get my books. You can download things immediately. I give instant advice immediately, 24/7. So nobody has to be in relationship pain.
Wonderful. Hey, Gilda, thank you so much for being here.
What a pleasure, Michael. Be well.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
And a love who's burning light. We'll warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore.
There's a new film out. It's called The Conspirator. It's directed by Robert Redford. It's in the theaters nationwide. Now, the film is about the trial of the conspirators in the plot to kill Abraham Lincoln, and it's sparking a lot of conversations about modern political issues, how history repeats itself, and the American justice system. Our guest is James Solomon. He's a screenwriter. Despite the parallels to contemporary post 9/11 politics, James has wrote this script. It was way before 9/11 and has made appearances on PBS, News Shore, MSNBC's Andrea Mitchell Reports, and Fox News Channel. And let us say, James, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Great to be with you and your listeners.
Oh, James, thank you so much for being here. You know, I would venture to guess, in and of its own sense, history does repeat itself, but it doesn't necessarily have to be follow a particular political path or a political pattern. So I'm going to go all the way back to the beginning with Conspirator. What was it that sparked the idea behind it, and what do we see that we recognize within that script as the watcher?
Well, that's a good question. I'll take you back to the first few months of President Clinton's first term. That's how long it's been. I started this in 1993. The Conspirator is about one of the great, fascinating American stories, hardly known. Most of your listeners probably are aware, and everyone thinks they know the story of the Lincoln assassination. Booth shoots President Lincoln in Ford's Theater, end of story. It turns out the actual story is far more fascinating and what took place that night. When I first started this in 1993, I wasn't aware that on the night that President Lincoln was assassinated, the Secretary of State was nearly killed, that there was someone at the residence of the Vice President to kill him, that hundreds were rounded up, that a trial, a military trial of 8 civilians took place shortly after, that one of the 8 on trial was a woman who ran a boarding house named Mary Surratt, and that she was likely on trial for crimes committed by her own son, None of that I knew when I started, and that was a starting point. And at the center of The Conspirator, the movie, as you say, that is directed by Robert Redford, is an extraordinary human story of a mother, Mary Surratt, who is played by Robin Wright in the film, abandoned by her own son, and a surrogate son, her Northern Union war hero lawyer, Frederick Aiken, who is played by James McAvoy in the movie, who comes to the aid of a Southern woman, Mary Surratt, who is accused of murdering his commander-in-chief. That human story at the center is what fascinated in me and is what has been the focus of this, is the focus of this screenplay and has been the focus of much of my attention over the last 18 years.
So realistically, it wasn't just about Abraham Lincoln's assassination. It was a plot to get rid of basically the entire administration in one fell swoop, but they didn't get it done.
Well, that's right. And few of us know, maybe some of your listeners do, that the assassination actually took place 5 days after the Confederate General Lee had surrendered to the Union General Grant, and it was in the last days of the Civil War.
You know, by the way, I had no, until just now, I had no idea.
Members of the Confederacy led by Booth to decapitate the government, to essentially achieve what the Confederacy had been unable to accomplish on the battlefield, and they nearly accomplished that. And so Washington City on the night of April 14, 1865, was a very scary place to be, with unclear as to how broad the conspiracy was. And as you know, we tend to often look for conspiracies where they do or don't exist. And here is an extraordinarily remarkable conspiracy that actually did exist, but that so few of us are aware of.
Well, you bring up an interesting point. If Lee surrendered and the conspiracy went on, was Lee's surrender part and parcel of the conspiracy? Because if it was, what a brilliant operation that would have been. We're going to give up, so it's all over with. Everybody puts their arms down. You open yourself up. Lincoln goes out unguarded, and you nail him, and you get
well,
arrested.
Well, you know, Michael, that isn't, no, they're not connected. Lee's surrender to Grant was a very much an honorable surrender. There were Confederate forces further in the South that still were engaged in the war, and so the war was not completely over. It was the actual assassination, that conspiracy, they were not part and parcel or connected, although initially the government believed that the conspiracy in Booth was hatched, that Booth had hatched that at the highest levels of the Confederacy. But there's no evidence to suggest that, in fact, it was. That it was Booth on the day of April 14th, around noon, who learned that Booth was that Lincoln was supposed to appear at Ford's Theater with the Grants, Mr. and Mrs. Grant, General and Mrs. Grant, and President and Mrs. Lincoln were going to appear together at Ford's Theater. The Grants, Mrs. Grant, didn't get on so well with Mrs. Lincoln, and so they canceled. So just President Lincoln and Mrs. Lincoln went with another couple. But Booth put this plan into action on the day of, and as I said, he nearly accomplished what he set out to do, which was to decapitate the government. And the trial that you alluded to and that I spoke to about at the outset took place roughly 1 month after the assassination, and in the context of a time when the war was still not finished.
No, by the way, two things here. One, on the fun side, would be what a great concept for a movie. Time travelers come back, you create the scenario I was talking about, and now all of a sudden the South didn't really give up. They get rid of everybody running the North. Now they're controlling the country. Interesting how things would have turned out. But beyond that,
you think like a Hollywood screenwriter for sure.
Oh, this is the fun stuff. Okay. Now, but let's take it to where it really is. James, this is the first time, and I've stayed pretty much abreast of what goes on in history, you know, doing what I do for all these years, that I've got to kind of keep my fingers on the pulse of what's going on and what's going to come at me. But the key is, this is the first time that I ever heard this part of this phase of it, this facet of it. Why was it kept secret? And when I say secret, maybe it wasn't kept under lock and key, but I don't think the average person even knows what we're talking about here.
Well, Michael, I think you're entirely right. I think most of us don't know this story, and that's what, in part, what makes it such a remarkable story, although the assassination is part of it, this extraordinary human drama of a mother and son and the surrogate son. This triangle is what is makes the conspirator, I think, deeply resonant and timeless. Why we don't know, most of us don't know that, let's just say why there were, most of us don't know there were multiple attacks that night is still a great mystery to me. I think one possible explanation is that it was the goal of the Secretary of War, who was arguably the most powerful person in Washington City after Lincoln died, and he was Edwin Stanton. He's played in the film by beautifully by Kevin Klein, the great actor. Stanton wanted to make sure that the war stayed won, and he wanted to make sure that the conspirators on trial, there were eight, were dead and buried and forgotten, and he accomplished that. That's part of an explanation as to why we don't know. One could also speculate that as a society, we tend to focus on an individual and the cult of personality, and that's how we only know about Booth, et cetera. But it is remarkable how few of us do know what took place on the night of April 14th, and I think that is probably one of the things that will fascinate your listeners when they go to see the movie. The point you made at the outset about it being sort of deeply resonant. This is a movie in which Robert Redford and this extraordinary cast, which includes also James McAvoy, Robin Wright, I mentioned Kevin Klein, Tom Wilkinson, Evan Rachel Wood, Danny Houston, Justin Long, Alexis Bledel, Cole Meany, and it really an incredible ensemble cast of superb actors who have, and all of us, have sort of painstakingly worked to faithfully recreate the night of April 14th, 1865, and the days soon after.
You know, I love Cole Meany because he appears in movies. No matter where you look, he's always there somewhere. So, I mean, the guy's a great actor. He's taken on so many different parts. But I want to go back to something in the very beginning. The film, you know, obviously about the trial of the conspirators, we're talking about that. The conversations, the modern political issues, how history repeats itself, the American justice system, how are people tying that in? I mean, I know it's not the movie, but how are they tying it in? How can they make this a left-right issue?
Well, it's a really a good question, and when I first started writing this piece and people read it, they would say, fascinating story. As you just said, I didn't know this happened. And some would say very nicely told, but what's its relevance to today? After September 11th, 2001, I never heard that. And part of the reason, a large part of the reason, is the central aspect of this trial, military trial of eight civilians, was the question of whether or not where safety, security, and civil liberties fit in. And so I was writing in the 1990s a story about a military trial of civilians at a time of war and questions about the law and safety, security, when those were more abstract notions in the 90s. And after 2001, naturally, they've been very much on our mind. And so the movie portrays the events as they occurred in 1865, but the parallels to the present are there.
All right, so when we talk about the parallels, what are we talking about? Are we talking about where they're going to be tried? Are they effectively, is it a war crime or are they civilians? All of those questions would truly have to come up. Even if there were a civilian, the war just ended. It was obviously attacking the President of the United States and the rest of who they tried to kill. So were they enemies of the country? I mean, those are the things that we are actually facing today, whether they're going to be tried in Gitmo or they're going to be tried here in Washington. So some of the very same themes seem to, again, appear when you say it that way.
Well, you're absolutely right, Michael. What took place on April 14th, 1865 was an unprecedented act of violence against on American soil, in which its first presidential assassination, the roundup of many, the calling those who had been involved public enemies, similar to sort of enemy combatants, if you will, the holding of the detainees, the defendants with hoods and in images that were reminiscent of what we saw in the first years in Guantanamo, and a military trial, and questions of whether or not it was appropriate to try defendants in a civil or military court. That's what I was writing. That's what we are portraying. But that is what took place in 1865. And any parallel to the present wasn't intended. It just in portraying the events as faithfully as possible. And I will just mention the movie is produced by a new company called the American Film Company. The gentleman behind the company is a gentleman named Joe Ricketts. And Mr. Ricketts may be familiar to some listeners because his family owns the Chicago Cubs. He was also one of the founders of Ameritrade. And he believes that American historical films done authentically and accurately not only inform but will entertain audiences. And this movie, first and foremost, is entertaining. And we had an extraordinary team of advisors who worked in consulting in the production that included one of which was a gentleman named Fred Bork. In addition to being a full-time legal historian with the Armed Services, one of two, he was also the lead prosecutor at Guantanamo in 2003 and 2004, so he combines a fascinating real-world and historical knowledge. We also had James McPherson, the preeminent Civil War-era scholar. So it was a very interesting collection of consultants who worked on this and making sure that we faithfully portrayed the events as they occurred.
It would have to be tough. James, I learned a very valuable lesson probably 5-6 years ago, and it had to do with the immigration law and how that would tie in also to what we're talking about. I was always of the opinion that if you're illegal is the operative word, you do not have the rights of a citizen, of a legal citizen. And what I learned, and I had to get on the air and totally correct myself, because what I learned was that the moment, whether you're legal, illegal, it doesn't matter. The moment you put your foot on this soil, the Constitution doesn't say people, it doesn't say citizen, it says people. And the moment you put your foot on this soil, you have all the rights and privileges, not the privileges, you have all the rights afforded by the Constitution of anybody who is a citizen. That's one of the big battles that they're going on now with Gitmo. You bring them here, they all of a sudden have all the rights of a citizen. You can't try them as war criminals. And I would imagine that the same problem was existing back in 18-odd-odd when this actually happened. How do you try them? But the Constitution says this. It had to be very confusing to set it up in such a way that you level the playing field for everybody.
Well, in 1865, it's an interesting point you're making. In 1865, when the assassination took place, the arguments were essentially this. Washington City, the civil courts had been open and functioning throughout the war, so they were still open and functioning and could conduct a civil trial of these conspirators who were, as you point, we discussed, U.S. citizens.
Sure.
However, the counterargument was that this was an act of war, perceived to be, that there were 50,000 troops that were protecting Washington. Washington is a southern city. It was very close to Richmond, the capital of the Confederacy, less than 100 miles. And that's the counterargument, that it is a military state requires a military trial. In the year after this trial, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a different matter that as long as the courts are open and functioning, that civilians, American citizens, are entitled to a trial by jury. Now, that was the ruling in federal court. And again, I'm not taking a position one way or the other, one way or the other with regard to current circumstances. It's just in terms of the trial that actually took place at that time. These were the sort of arguments. What is interesting is the tension, the stress that is placed on our Constitution, the laws, and safety and security and civil liberty issues. There is a similarity in the sense that as happened in 1865 and as has happened since 2001, there is a stress that's placed on these issues. And when I first started writing it in the 1990s, these were more abstract ideas, and certainly to your listeners and to viewers of the movie, they're palpably aware these are no longer so abstract. They're very real issues that we have confronted with.
James Solomon, I'll tell you one thing. After this interview, I'm going to go see the movie now.
Well, I appreciate it. I hope a lot of your listeners go. And as I said, it's really entertaining. It's riveting. It's a riveting story. I felt at times like a basketball referee refereeing a championship game. Just stay out of the way of the players. The story is so great. The real story that took place is so remarkable. Just to tell it has been such a pleasure. And in fact, all screenwriters look for dream about stumbling upon a screen story like this. And it turned out it's been under our noses. It's been a real pleasure to tell it. If I were told 18 years ago that Robert Redford would be directing my screenplay and that it would feature this type of cast, I'd assigned for that and waited for this. It's really remarkable how beautifully portrayed it is by Redford and company, and it is really like hitting the lottery.
Wonderful. Hey, James Solomon, we're about out of time. Website, we can find out more about the movie.
Conspirator, I'm just looking it up. It's Conspirator.
TheMovie.com. I got it.
ConspiratorMovie.com. Great. Thank you. And it is, as you said, nationwide. So I hope folks get to see it, and I really appreciate you giving the movie and me the time.
Wonderful. Hey, James, thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking, turn near. You'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you've adored, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore.
Gene Marish with us, PhD. He's the author of 101 Resumes Plus. This is the second edition. Has over 13 years experience teaching business and computer technology in several colleges. He's got over 26 years experience in the world of business and marketing. And he's got over 15 years military experience. His third book, 701 Resumes Plus, second edition, offers his unique perspective on employment from both sides of the interview table. And let's say, Gene, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's 7,001.
I'm sorry.
Who's counting? Who's counting?
That's a couple of them. Well, what's a few zeros between friends?
7,000. Exactly.
Okay, let me ask you this. They've been interesting because of your military experience. Is there a difference between the average person going after a job in a civilian level, or if you want to get that job in a military organization, is there a difference in the way that you approach it?
Well, you know, in the military, a lot of times the military is going to tell you where you're going to go. I mean, normally when you enlist in the military, you pick a field, and if you go to school and you test for it and what have you, move into it. That's the way the military normally happens. You're more selected than the fact that you select the job. And private life, of course, you're going after a specific job that you've selected.
You know, there's so many people that are so interested in getting a job because of the economy that they'll take anything that there is to take because they're frightened to death that they won't get anything. But some jobs aren't the right jobs, are they?
No, but unfortunately, if you've got a family to feed, you may have to take something that isn't not necessarily what you want to do. And in my career, I've done that. And you find something better, and you leave that other off your resume, and you just keep going.
You know, the one thing I've learned, and it's been so long since I've had a job, but I've learned many, many years ago that if you're going to be interviewed for a job, it's a reversible cause and effect. That most people don't get it, but they should be interviewing the person that's interviewing them, because if you don't like what you get once you got in, you got a problem, and you got to know exactly what it is you're walking into.
Yes, besides the fact that when you're interviewing them, that indicates that you're interested in the job and interested in who you're working with, and that's a way of scoring also points.
Now, by the way, an interesting thing, because we're in a completely different economical condition than we were 10, 15 years ago, and who knows what it's going to be in 5 or 10 years from now. Job opportunities, trends, obviously. Are they going to change? Are they going to be the same? Are there things that we need to look at and prepare for ahead of time?
Well, I think we've already seen a lot of jobs go overseas, many, many jobs overseas, and the jobs that we are normally qualified for. Looking back really quickly, one of the things that I've interviewed a lot of times, and one of the things I ran into, a Chinese company, for example, wanted to know, I was a sales and marketing guy, they wanted to know, could you speak Chinese and could you speak Spanish? So, yes, that's probably more prevalent today, having a special, unique skill than it was ever before.
No, good point, because realistically, we are dealing in a global marketplace, but it's not just the job that we have here. Now, the employment opportunities, you know, obviously you can't listen to government. Doesn't mean if you're left or right or indifferent, but the government, the administration, no matter who that is always going to make themselves look good and say jobs are wonderful and plentiful. What do we really have to look at when we are dealing with jobs today? What is it that the average person needs to know before they go out on the street to get that job?
Well, I think one of the things that you got to know what you can do, you got to know yourself. That'd be number one. So know what you're selling. You know, because remember, bottom line, you are a product. And you are a product, they are looking for a specific kind of product. That's one thing that we need. The second thing that we probably need more than ever, and it's always been true, is we need to be doing a lot of networking, and then to get the job that you want, we need to have a champion to help you get in.
And now, by the way, I really believe that absolutely people need help. That doesn't mean that people are weak and they can't do it by themselves. But there's always that point where you need that somebody who's stronger than you and that's been there, done that, to look and see those things that look for those things that you don't see and point them out so you know going in.
Well, yeah, and well, the thing is open the door. If you talk to many employers before this all went down, they would like to hire your father, your uncle, your buddy, or that sort of thing to get that endorsement. So that's even more so today, because if they are running an ad, if you run an ad for, let's say you run an ad for 3 people, you're going to get 300 showing up.
So, no question. Today, yes.
Yeah, today. So if they can avoid interviewing 300 people, they're certainly going to do it. It saves them a whole lot of money, and it saves them a lot of time, and, of course, time is money. So that is more valuable today than ever before, and it's valuable to you because I did a section in the book that I did on how many applicants apply to certain top jobs in America. and some of the companies were getting $6,000, $30,000. All right, you want to send your resume into a company that gets 39,000 resumes plus yours?
Not necessarily. Now, by the way, one other question. I think it's important. The you know, we're going to have to let up on our ability to start to drill here. Texas is a great place to drill. Alaska's still got some untapped natural resources. And you're looking at three or four or five of the different states that are by different lakes that we can do things in. Geographically, is there a particular part of the nation that people should move to where the job opportunities are growing and they'll be plentiful compared to what they are now?
That's exactly what you should be looking at. And that's exactly what the kind of thing that the posture you're going to have to take is you need to go where the jobs are. They're not going to, you can't trust them coming to you. Now, which is a big deal for a lot of people, moving your home, your family, that sort of thing is a very difficult position to be in. But if your future lies in your career, you need to make that move, and you need to kind of look very closely to see what states have the greatest number of jobs. For example, Texas, as a matter of fact, has one of the largest number of corporate offices in America today, and that's Time Magazine or whatever. So, yes, you got to move where the jobs are.
You know, interestingly enough, too, the preparation for the jobs, you know, I go back to a time when there were kids that learned, you know, they had wood shop, auto shop, you know, metal shop, and so on and so forth. And they went out and they got into these, you know, they got into manual labor or they were skilled in a particular thing. Tearing down an auto engine today is not like what it was 30, 40, 50 years ago. So we're looking at high tech no matter where you go. How do you prepare? How do you know what to prepare for?
Well, you got to look at trends. I mean, you got to look and see what's the trends. You got to listen to what's going on. And there is somewhat of a guess, but there are things that we do know. In fact, I took those classes myself. I started out in auto mechanics 100 years ago.
But you have to look at the trends, and
like I talked to you earlier about language. You know, they're telling you need to take a language. You need to take two or three. Well, at least one, a second language, and you need to get a vocation that looks like aviation, aerospace, you know, it's still electronics. There are things that we see that are developing and are by being able to watch what's being advertised or promoted to us, if you will, in Time Magazine and the medias of what the trends might be. And there's somewhat a guess to that, too.
Would it be smart if I had a particular area that I wanted to move into, get a job with, do the training for, and if I researched and I found out where in the country that they would be promoting this kind of work, would it be smart to move ahead of it, move there ahead of time and be ahead of the game before anybody else hit?
If you can, if you can. That's one reason why we suggest that you not get married and have a whole lot of children right away, and have a, because that gives you the ability to be more fluent, and you can move around. But yes,
okay.
The answer is being simply, yeah, would be absolutely.
Right, if you can search it, if you can find it. Now, when you deal with income today, that's a very interesting thing that you're dealing with knowing how much that somebody's going to offer and how much you have to make. I give you the price of gasoline going up at the pumps right now. Not only that, the cost of the transportation to get to goods and services or goods to those places that do the services, it's going to be very interesting. Somebody might get a job today and think they're making great money, and 6 months from now, it's not enough to live on. How can you project that?
Well, again, it's being somewhat projected. One of the problems is you need to take a look at the kinds of the skill that you're going into, the career that you're going into. Where does it plateau as far as income is concerned? And those things are projected on the internet, which is great for information. So there is information available about economics or incomes that one would make or one potentially could make that you have to be aware of, and you can't go into a career that doesn't pay very well, or you should be able to understand where you're going to go. Some people want to be an artist. they're probably never going to make a whole lot of money, but they get utter gratification. So money is not the only gratification you get out of it. There's a pride in what you do. So you got to take in consideration of how you look at the economics of the job and how it personally affects you as an individual.
Now, by the way, obviously there's different types of business, but the average business exec, what do they look for in somebody new? Are there certain red flags to say no, or are there indicators that this is the kind of guy, this is the kind of woman that they're going to want? What do they look for today as opposed to what they look for in, we'll call it, yesteryear?
You know, I think a lot of stuff is still the same when you get right down to it. You know, they're looking for somebody who is interested in making money for their company. And that's the bottom line. And if you can project the fact that you're interested in the company, interested in the business, interested in growing, that's going to be giving you a lot of forward movement in that particular situation.
Now, by the way, we've got major companies now. We've also got the smaller companies, the average companies. What should somebody look for? Should they go to the majors, or are there advantages to go to that smaller company?
Yes and no. I tell you, in fact, I tend to like the smaller corporation. They tend to be able, or smaller company, they tend to not have as the greater demands on skill. Don't get pigeonholed quite as readily as you will with a major corporation, because they have a lot of opportunities within the company, depending on the size of the small company. I happen to like a small company, the opportunity for to grow. Also, there's a risk. Small companies can go out of business. Bigger corporations can go out of business, but tend not to as often, more today than ever before. But if you become an engineer in a big company, you're going to be an engineer most of the time. I remember a time where I just got out of junior college, and I got a job in engineering on the boards. Back in the old days when there were boards.
Sure.
Maybe you can remember that.
My grandfather tells me about that.
I went to my boss one day, and I said, you know, I knew myself that I could do this, but I knew that I had feelings that I could sell better. So I said, I want to go into estimating, and there was a job there. But he wouldn't let me go because he needed me in that spot. In a small company, you probably have more flexibility and can make that move. In convincing your employer or the president of the company that you would be more valuable to the company in another position. So there is a little bit of opportunity to maybe wear a different hat in a smaller company, which you wouldn't do in a large company. You're not going to be the vice president of a company normally in a big corporation, but you might be able to work your way up in a small company much quicker.
James, let me take you to the beginning now, okay? Because to start all of this, you need to have a resume. Any way you look at it, any way you slice it, you need a resume. A resume is not just a resume, is it? A resume, there's got to be some creativity to it, some purpose to it, some focus. When somebody's doing a resume, what are one of the things that they really need to accomplish within that resume?
Well, you may need more than one. There are several different kinds. There are combination resume, and there are various types of resumes that pull things together. But you, first of all, you have to have something to sell, and that's gotten through the experience and the training, that sort of thing. And then that resume is a device that presents these items, what you can do or what you have to sell to the potential employer. So it's a selling tool, and it needs to have the buzzwords and the kinds of things that, unfortunately, they want to hear. And that's, you'd have to design it in that way that's going to convey your best foot forward.
Now, Gene, we're starting to run out of time now. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at?
Well, I have, my website is called, all one word, www, of course, CamelSealBooksInc.com.
Okay, CamelSealBooksInc.com, and we can get the different books, and if you're doing workshops, seminars, we can follow you there.
Yeah, I've been trying to do that, but my books are certainly from my website. Actually, you can get a better deal if you go to the major bookselling websites on the Internet, the Barnes & Nobles and those sorts of things. I have two e-books. I have another book that I've written I wrote for high school kids in career education. Similar book, but for a little different level. But you can go there and see what I'm presenting, and certainly the books are available almost anywhere.
I'll give you this. I'll go back with you age-wise. I was trained on a manual typewriter. How's that?
So was I.
I
when I went to San Jose State in business education, we had to take a methods class, and it was we had to type 44 words a minute or 45 on a manual.
Oh, I love every second of that. Okay. Hey, Gene, thank you
so much. So I've been
there,
too. And I've gone through the manual and electric, and now we're using and again, that's another skill you have to have. I have a friend of mine, he says he has a company up in Northern California. He tells me, I don't know how to run a computer. Well, I hope you don't tell your, if you were interviewing a potential employer, that you don't know how to run a computer.
The way you handle that is very simple. I'll take the job. I know 6 or 7 12-year-olds. You're good. Hey, Gene, thank you so much
for
joining
That'd be
us.
One way to handle it. But you can say, I'm taking a course on that. That's another way to handle it. You know, one time if you're interviewing and the guy says, do you know Spanish or Chinese or whatever, and you don't say no, you say, I'm taking a course on that. And
absolutely.
To enhance my resume and background.
Good point. Okay, we got to get out of here. Gene, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, and you're very welcome. I appreciate working with you.
Oh, take care. Good night.
Good night.
Brave and faithful and true, and cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you, and I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, yours, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I've had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Let me see if I can find the magic angel floating around the board and the mixers and the rest of it. Seth is our guest up.
Yes.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, let's do this and rock. Or something like that. Okay.
Once upon a time.
Carla Mullen with us. She is the author of After Image, a broken-hearted memoir of a charmed life. She grew up in Los Angeles, graduated from the Oakwood School in North Hollywood, later graduated Phi Beta Kappa and magnum cum laude from UCLA with a BA in English. She worked in the film industry, both in production and development. Later, she and her husband, Lawrence Starkman, wrote 12 feature film screenplays, worked as a rewrite Guns for Hire on various projects, and penned and produced the short romantic comedy Wit and Charm, which won several awards. They also wrote and created a series of Sin Golden Eagle Award-winning art history films. She's currently completing her first novel, as well as a children's book illustrated by her daughter, Cami Starkman, who attends the American Film Institute in Los Angeles. Carla, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, we're talking about your agonizing 11-month journey when your husband was diagnosed with cancer. Let me ask you this. And this is not one of the questions of how did you feel about. That's not where I'm at with this at all. But you guys had a very active, very, very productive life. And all of a sudden you have you have a message that it may stop. What was it like? How did you deal with that?
I think with a great deal of industrial strength denial, we never thought that our lives were going to stop. I think we just thought we could plow through this, that ultimately it would be a blip in our lives that would continue to be productive. Certainly for the first 6 months, we thought that. And he'd undergone surgery, he underwent chemotherapy and was really the poster child for how you do that. And then with the recurrence, which was the last 3 months of his life, then we, you know, certainly we both knew in the backs of our minds that this was not a good thing, but we never really addressed it.
Now, by the way, the book in and of itself, After Image, does the book trace it step by step of what you went through?
Yes, it sort of is a multi-layered kind of approach to my accounting of my personal experience in that, yes, it is a chronology of the medical saga and certainly, more importantly, I think, of the emotional saga. And then I punctuate the story with what I called snapshots, which are basically flashbacks. I didn't want my husband to be just a dying presence in this book and then a dead person. I wanted him to be a vibrant, living person, which I think is true to the experience of grieving for most people, that they want to recall that vibrant person. So I used this device of snapshots to just conjure up these little tiny moments of sort of human connection in his life that I think really spoke to who he was. And people seem to be responding to that because it is true to the grief experience that that's what you want to remember.
Carla, what did he leave? And when I say what did he leave, I don't mean anything physical, but emotional. What is that something with him that stayed with you, with your daughter, with the people he knows?
I think a tremendous sense of joy about life, a real joie de vivre, and a passion for everything that he did, whether it was cooking dinner just for the three of us in our little family at, you know, on a school night, or whether it was a huge film project. Whatever it was, he brought an enormous sense of joy and passion, and I think that's what people remember about him, that he had a sort of light about him, and that's certainly what I see when I look at my daughter.
Now, growing up in the industry that that you grew up in, when this happened, and growing up in that industry, you look at life just a little bit differently than the average person does. You see things in different perspectives. You see not only things that are, but your imagination and creativity, if you're going to write, how things could be and how outcomes begin. When you started going through this in your life, the way you were taught, the way you learned how to be, did that help you get through it?
I don't know that it helped. I'm sure that it certainly did color it. You're absolutely right about that, in that you sort of, I think there were moments when I was going through the experience when it was almost an out-of-body experience, and part of that, I think, was my training as a screenwriter, is sure. To listen to dialogue and think, oh, that's an interesting line of dialogue, or to sort of file it away in your memory bank as a visual image, and I think I had a certain amount of sort of strange out-of-body detachment in that way that probably was partially just self-preservation and also partially my training as a screenwriter. In terms of growing up in the business, my father was an actor, but that was what he did for a living. I didn't spend a lot of time on movie sets as a child or anything like that. But we were, a very close family, and I think that really had more to do with the experience than my professional background.
Yeah, by the way, I loved your dad, Carl Malden. I mean, there's
Thank
no question about
that.
Oh, yeah. He left an impact. But with what you're doing with the book, is the book in and of itself a legacy for your husband?
Yes, I hope so. I think subconsciously when I started to write the book, that was part of what I was striving for, was to bear witness to his life, which really was my entire life up to that point also, and to conjure the vibrant human being. Yes, I hope it is a legacy, and I would hope that it's something that he would be proud of.
Now, by the way, the word loss in and of itself, it has a tremendous impact on so many people. Is it another way of learning how to deal with loss? And I know this is going to be a tough question. It just hit me as I was thinking about this. What's the gain in it for you? And I don't mean a gain because he died, but there was something that had to happen, something where when the book was written that there was a part of you that grew. There's a dimension of you that wasn't here when this when you first found out. You had to grow through the book. You had to grow through looking at this and actually becoming, you know, the part of the legacy.
Well, I'll tell you, in a strange way, I think I grew up, period. I think that's the growth, was sort of hitting the brick wall of adulthood. I woke up one morning and I was a widow. And, you know, I'm a baby boomer. We're supposed to be the forever young generation. And I never felt like a grown-up, let alone a widow. I would look in the mirror and think, that's a word that can't possibly apply to me. And I think that's part of what writing the book was about for me, was to, first of all, as I said, bear witness to this incredible life and to our marriage, but also to reclaim my own self. Not only was my husband and my best friend, but he was also my writing partner. We were screenwriters together for a number of years, as you mentioned earlier. And I think part of it was that I needed to prove to myself that I could still write on my own, though this wasn't a screenplay, but that it was still something that I could do. So it was sort of a rediscovering of at least an element of my own identity in the writing of the book. And I think in terms of growth with the general experience of loss as a totality that you mentioned, I'm a better person now, for sure. I don't sweat the small stuff. I know that's a cliche, but it's really true. I'm not afraid of being humiliated or embarrassed. I'm not as self-conscious. I think I'm much more open to a lot of things. I'm a better person. And if there's a takeaway in the book that I would like other people to have, it's that let's try to bring that better self to the people we love before it's too late, you know. And which is not to say I didn't have a fabulous marriage, but I think you know what I mean. It's that I learned something that I wish he could have seen.
And well, in addition to that, it's like every time you see your daughter, you kiss her. You heard what I'm saying.
Absolutely. That anyway, thank God.
Yeah, really. But, you know, and I've seen a few people, when it's got to that point where they knew that they were gone, there was nothing that they could do. Do you remember, being in the industry, do you remember Joy Selznick?
I know Joyce, the name.
Yeah. Joyce was, she was a... I'll call you at 4 o'clock in the morning when I remember what she was, but I saw her.
I know the feeling.
Yeah, we get older; it happens to us. But we get to a point where when you know it's going to happen, and there's not a whole heck of a lot of anything that you can do about it. And every day, you know, I turn around and look at the age that I am now, and you know, 12 seconds ago I was in high school, and 14 seconds ago I was in grammar school, and I couldn't wait to get into the seventh grade, and I couldn't wait till I was 21 so I could walk into a bar, right? And we wait, and we can't wait, and what happens is we dilute the living that we're living now.
And we're not every, in the moment, yes.
Yes. And they don't get it, and it's too bad you have to be knocked down or something tragic happened in your life before you realize that every moment in and of itself, it's its own specialness. And no matter how hard it looks at the time, there's a reason that it's happening and there is a growth process in it if you just open up to it.
Well, it's all really we really have, isn't it, is this particular moment. I mean, we have memory and we have dreams and the ability to envision a future, but all we really have is this moment. So, yes, yeah, I agree with you.
By the way, I just remembered, Joyce was a casting director.
Okay.
And she was related to David O. Selznick.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I just thought being around in the industry, she's probably been gone for about 20 years now.
Mm-hmm.
But the point of contention, I really believe, is this, that cancer, very interestingly, is if you really got down to what it was or what it is, it's the body eating the body up. And I'm wondering seriously, when people get this kind of a disease, if they could catch themselves, if they can go back and just say, what it is about my life, what is it about me that's causing me to eat myself up? And, you know, there have been times when people have moved through when they, you know, they've had debilitating diseases that were supposed to die and they didn't die. So everything is a step back. Take a look at it symbolically. What does it mean to you? And that's your time to move forward.
Well, I tell you, my theory about cancer, and of course, I'm not a medical person. I'm just a mother who plays one on television.
You were there.
I was there, absolutely, and I did a lot of research. I think that it's a constellation of factors that cause someone to get cancer, and that we're all walking around with a lot of them: dietary, environmental, stress. We can control some of them. We can't control others. Certainly, genetic predisposition is one we cannot control. That's probably the biggest. And I think each individual has his or own own tipping point, as it were, and you just don't know what's going to tip that delicate balance, you know? As for the question of intentionality, that's kind of like the secret kind of stuff that you're mentioning. I'm not sure I quite agree with that. I think that it causes patients an enormous amount of guilt to think you kind of brought this on yourself. But I do know what you're saying in that it can be cause for self-examination that can be worthwhile.
Sure. I mean, and effectively, it's a very hard thing to say to a patient, you did this to yourself. There's no question about that. And in the end result, it all has to do with whether it's cancer or something else. It all has to, by the way, I've been there, done that, so I'm not talking about from the outside looking in.
Sure,
I was
sure.
There. Okay. So, but the point of contention is that even in so many cases, if we just sit back and take a look at it from a teenager on up, and all the conditions in our life, what do we draw to us, and what is it telling us about ourselves? And I think really if we get strong enough to realize that, man, how life turns around.
Yes, I think so. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Or can turn around.
Can turn around, yes.
Yeah.
I think, you know, there are so many factors. It's like for people who have migraine headaches, you know, you control the factors you can because there are so many that you can't. That's just my personal theory of it. And I don't want to give the impression that afterimage is really, you know, an entirely medical saga. It's not at all. It's much more about the emotional underpinnings of the experience.
Sure. Oh, no question about it. And I really believe that most disease, most debilitating disease today, they don't have to have the worst end result. And a lot of that is that stress and all the things that you were talking about that take their toll, they affect the immune system. The immune system can't work the way it's supposed to do, and you end up the way you end up. That's not for everybody, obviously. But I really believe in my heart of hearts, we have so much control over the way that we deal with things. Somebody can walk up and slap me. I can't stop you from slapping me, but I do control how I feel about what just happened, and it's up to me to be able to deal with it in the way that I want to deal with it. And the minute that I know I have that kind of control over my own emotions, all of a sudden the world is very different.
Well, that's certainly part of what I talk about in the book, is the whole concept of control. That was very big for me. I'm kind of a self-admitted control freak. I say it right here. And to be thrust into the middle of this situation where everything was so out of my control was absolutely terrifying. And I write a lot about that panic, and it seems to be something that people are responding to. I think that's a very common reaction.
Oh, no question. Now, by the way, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this, Carla. Do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. www.carlamalden, all one word, .com.
Now, by the way, can we buy the book there?
Yes, you can buy the book. You can be linked to buy the book there. It is available for purchase on Amazon as we speak. They jumped the gun and started shipping a little early, so they have it. And it will be in bookstores on this coming Tuesday, the 3rd.
Wonderful. Hey, Carla Malden, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Take care. Good night.
Put some saxes with them,
strings, pizzicato,
add some rhythm.
As long as we're singing,
then the world's all right and everything's swinging.
Long as we're singing now.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and thanks for listening, and tell your friends about the show. That's the way we grow. That's what you call network. And I'm Michael Ray, and that, my friends, is a wrap.